Mark chapter 9, from verses 14 to 29. When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, and saw scribes arguing with them. When the whole crowd saw him, they were immediately overcome with awe, and they ran forward to greet him. He asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" Someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. And whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so." He answered them, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. When his spirit saw him, immediately it threw the boy into convulsions. And he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you are able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes." Immediately, the father of the child cried out, "I believe, help my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You spirit that keep this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." After crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he was able to stand. When he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "This kind can come out only through prayer. And God always blesses his public reading of his inspired and infallible word."
Sunday night has a particular kind of grace on it. It's not the best version of you that comes to church on a Sunday night. It's often the real you, the one who has carried the week and needs grace and strength for the week ahead, the one who has wrestled with disappointment, the one who has tried to be strong for everyone else but needs the strength of God. And I want to talk to you tonight by beginning with a sentence that you have heard read to you that is so honest, it feels like it was written for modern day London. Not for the polished or the sorted or the spiritually fluent, but for the honest, the sincere. "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." Mark chapter 9, verse 24. That's not the prayer of someone who has it all figured out. That's the prayer of someone who's doing what many of us are doing tonight, standing in the tension of faith on the one hand and uncertainty on the other. Hope rising and doubt whispering. And here is the good news that I want to give you at the start of the evening. Jesus does not despise such cries. He doesn't turn away from an honest heart. Often in churches, particularly like ours, it can feel as if your faith isn't perfect, God won't hear you. Nothing could be further from the truth. God hears the whispered cry of somebody gripped with uncertainty in the same way as he hears the cry of someone who is gripped with the certainty of their belief in Jesus. This man came not really sure, and God heard him. Because Jesus never turns away from an honest heart. He is not offended by our struggles. He steps into them. Tonight, Jesus offers you hope and me. He comes here to this meeting by the power of his Holy Spirit, online, around the world, and in the room. For those who are weary, for those who can only whisper help. So if you've come saying, I've got faith, brilliant. If you've come saying, I've got questions, brilliant. You are welcome too. If you've come saying, I don't know if I can believe like I used to, you're not disqualified. You are welcome too. You are exactly the kind of person that Jesus meets in Mark chapter 9. It opens with Jesus having been on a mountain. Glory and transfiguration and radiant splendor and heaven touching earth. It's all happened at the end of Matthew chapter 8 and the beginning of Matthew chapter 9. Three of his closest friends, Peter, James, and John, have seen Jesus completely transfigured, changed. His appearance has revealed something of who he has always been, like a curtain being lifted so that Peter, James, and John can see who he is. And then they walk down the hill together. They descend the mountain. And at the foot of the mountain, it isn't quiet. It's not orderly. It's chaotic. There's a crowd. There are scribes, lawyers, whose job it is to record the truth. There are disciples, people who are following Jesus. There are arguments. There is pressure. And at the center of it all, there is a single family carrying a pain that has gone on far too long. It's one of the greatest kindnesses, I think, in the gospel, this story. It doesn't pretend life is tidy. It shows you that Jesus meets people, not just in holy moments, but in messy ones. Not just in the sanctuary or on the mountaintop, but at the school gate. And not only in worship, but in warfare. Not only in moments when we feel strong, but in moments when we feel like our soul is limping and we don't have any strength left. And then Jesus comes. And Mark says that the crowd is immediately amazed and they turn to him in Mark chapter 9, verse 15. But he doesn't get swept up into the spectacle. He doesn't get carried away. He asks a question that is both confronting and calming. What are you arguing about with them? Mark chapter 9, verse 16. I wonder how often people in London or people around the world see us arguing as Christians and say, what are you arguing about? This moment feels very painfully modern. Our public life can sometimes feel like one continuous comment thread. Everything becomes an argument. Everyone has a take. Everyone is certain about something. And the more we argue, the less we heal. You can feel it in our national mood sometimes. Not very often have I done this, but in the last couple of weeks, on more than one occasion, I said, oh, I can't be bothered with this. This nitpicking and fighting and arguing and mudslinging and pulling each other's character down in public discourse in the name of healthy politics. It's not healthy politics. It's disgraceful. One of the most profound interviews that I've seen in recent weeks was an interview I watched last night with an ex-prime minister called John Major on Newsnight, who talked about the need for politics and politicians to have integrity again, to believe in something, to put their head above the mudslinging that goes on and start to talk sense and remember that they are there to lead people, not to manipulate them or control them. Loud opinions, thin compassion, strong reaction, and weak tenderness leads to insecurity. And that scene was like this scene in the story. And Jesus steps into it and says, what are you fighting for? Because whilst people are debating and fighting and arguing, in this story, a child is suffering. Jesus is never impressed by noise that ignores pain. The presence of Jesus reorders things so that we can see what matters again. He doesn't join the argument. And he doesn't stand at the edge and critique the crowd. He walks into the center of it and he looks for the wounded boy. And then a man speaks out from the crowd. Mark chapter 9, verse 17. Teacher, I brought my son to you. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. The description is harrowing. It is of someone that sounds like they have what we would describe now as severe epilepsy. But in this passage, it is clear that there are demonic spirits at work. Convulsions, foaming, rigidity, these aren't minor inconveniences. This is a family living with ongoing torment. And then the father says, I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they couldn't do it. Mark chapter 9, verse 18. That sentence carries a particular weight, I think, don't you? We tried, but it didn't work. Some of you know that ache. You tried to change, you tried to stop, you tried to start again. You tried to forgive, you tried to pray, you tried to keep it together, you tried to hold your family in one place. You tried to hold your mind and it didn't work. And sometimes if we're really honest, the things that we've tried aren't wrong, they're just not enough. Because there are battles where human strength meets a ceiling. We can't fix everything. Then Jesus responds very strongly to his disciples in verse 19. You faithless generation, how much longer must I be amongst you? He sounds almost angry. I guess that depends on how you hear these words. You faithless generation, how much longer must I be amongst you? Or you faithless generation, how much longer must I be amongst you? Knowing that his time was coming. Trying to pack every moment with all that needed to be done. Read it with care, because Jesus isn't scolding. He's not wounding a wounded father. He wouldn't do that. Not the Jesus I know. He's grieving a world where unbelief has become normal and deliverance has become rare. He's groaning under the weight of the spiritual dullness of the moment and of public religion with no spiritual power. It's as if he's saying, but these people are supposed to believe in me, yet they can't demonstrate it. Maybe like the church in London. If we believe all of these things, why aren't we seeing more? And then he says the words that bring hope to so many in verse 19. Bring him to me. That's not a line that you should miss, because it's a line that changes everything. Not bring your explanation or bring your performance or bring your polished prayer or bring your 20 reasons that it didn't work. Bring him to me. And that's what Jesus is saying tonight. Bring the marriage to me. Bring the addiction to me. Bring the depression to me. Bring the anxiety to me. Bring the grief to me. Bring the unbelief to me. Bring the secret sin to me. Bring the family pain to me. Bring the child to me. Bring your life to me. Bring your brokenness to me. Because Jesus is never distant from suffering. He is always present to those who need him. The spirit in the boy reacts when he is brought to Jesus. Violence and convulsions and bondage expose themselves again in the presence of holiness in verse 20. And Jesus asks the Father a question. that shows the father heart of God. How long has this been happening to him? Verse 21. Do you see how kind that is? How compassionate Jesus is? Before he confronts the darkness, before he attends to the person, he cares about the story. He takes time to say, what's this been like for you? How long have you lived with it? Because Jesus cares about our timelines. And he cares about our stories. He cares about the length of our suffering. And then the father says something which I find profoundly moving from childhood. Verses 21 to 22, it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. It's as if this father says to Jesus, always. I don't remember a time when he was safe. We thought we were going to lose him again and again and again. We haven't been sure of what each day will bring. And I have no one else to come to. Let me share a testimony for a moment. Our second son, Benjamin, was born when we were at Bible College in 1995, November the 17th. And about 7 or 8 weeks after he was born, it was very clear that there was something very, very wrong. So he was taken into hospital. And since that time, he's now 31 this year. He's been on life support so many times. We were told he wasn't going to make it until 5. Then he wasn't going to make it until 10. Then he wasn't going to make it until 14 or 15. I lost count of the number of times that we were told, call your family because he's not going to get there. They treated him as if he had cystic fibrosis, but he doesn't. He just has a disorder that they can't get to the bottom of. He still has it. As recently as just a few months ago, they were trying to get to the bottom of his condition. They can't do it. They're thinking of naming a syndrome after him. And very often, I would watch my boy and I would say, how can he cope with this? And as a father, I've lost count of the number of times that I've closed the door and fallen to my knees and said, I don't know what to do. I've no one else to turn to. My wife and I have wept over him. We've cast everything that you could imagine out of him. We've laid hands on him. We've prayed for him. And thank God he is still alive, healthier than he has ever been. Married with 2 children, serving the Lord in pastoral ministry. But nevertheless, over the journey of his life, I've often come back to this passage and I've, if I'm being honest with you, said to God, do I lack faith for my son? Is it me? Is there something I could do or a button I could press? Is there a prayer I could pray or words that I could use that would make him better? And in the end, one comes to the conclusion that there are not. And I remember in one particular moment when he was on life support and Debbie stayed with him actually, and I was told to go home and call the family. And we were in Bible College and I was staying in a small flat. And on the way into the flat, the Bible College had graciously and kindly agreed to gather together and pray for Benjamin. And one of my colleagues from my year in college said, we've been praying for him. And God told us he's going to die because of sin in your life. And I said, I don't believe that. Didn't say told us, by the way, I beg your pardon. He said he's told me. And I said, I don't believe that. And I went in that night to this little flat and collapsed. And I don't know how long I wept and how long I cried out to God for. I don't know how long I prayed for. But somewhere in that journey, I heard God's voice. And I knew it was God's voice because I'd heard it before. On the night that I was born again, I heard the voice of Jesus. The weekend that I was born again. I was standing against a glass window in Belfast, hearing a preacher when I was 16. And I felt someone tap me on the shoulder. And a voice said to me, "Son, come home." And I knew it was God's voice. And that Friday, I left the open air. I was converted on the Sunday night. So I knew what God sounded like. And then I heard him again. Just under 10 years later, when my boy was sick. And God didn't use a lot of words. He simply said to me, "He's mine." And he didn't tell me that Benjamin was going to get better, and he didn't tell me that he was going to get worse. He didn't tell me he was going to heal him, and he didn't tell me he wasn't going to heal him. He just told me that he was his. And from that moment until now, I have not lost my peace over my son. Almost 32 years. Those two words, or three if you want to be a grammar pedant. He's mine. So I understand something of this man's cry. Always. From childhood, it has always cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. And then the father says something so revealing in verse 22, "But if you are able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." If you're able. That's not sarcasm. This man's exhausted. It's the cautious language of someone who has been disappointed too many times. And then Jesus replies, "If you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes." In verse 23, Jesus isn't mocking him. He's repositioning him. The father's question is about Jesus' ability, but Jesus gently turns it into a question of trust. "Will you bring what you have to me?" And watch what the father does. It's breathtaking. He doesn't fake certainty. He doesn't put on a show. He doesn't attempt religious confidence. Mark says, "And immediately the father of the child cried out," in verse 24. That word "cried out" in Greek carries a sense of desperation. It's an unguarded cry. It's not a neat prayer. And if you've ever been in a position like this, you know exactly what it sounds like. It's like someone who's drowning. And what is it that he says? "I believe. Help my unbelief." It's one of the most beautiful prayers in the Bible because it is so human. And it reveals the kind of people that Jesus rescues. Honest people. In Britain, we have mastered the art of looking okay. We can be falling apart and still say, "Not too bad." We can be anxious and still say, "I'm all right, you know." We can be grieving with broken hearts and still say, "Can't complain." We've inherited a cultural instinct to stay composed and polite and to keep things moving. But in Mark 9, the father doesn't manage the room. He's not trying to protect his image. He's not worried about his followers. He cries out. And my Jesus doesn't shame him for his lack of composure. He honors him for his honesty. Sometimes the miracle begins when we stop being fine and we start being honest in the presence of God. Jesus can work with honesty. He can work with help. He can work with, "I don't understand." He can work with, "I'm trying." He can work with, "I believe, but I'm struggling." But he can't work with lies. And then Jesus sees the crowd running together. when the moment becomes public and pressurized and he acts decisively. Verse 25, you spirit that keeps this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. Do you hear the change of tone? When he's talking to the boy's father, he's gentle and kind and compassionate and understanding. When he's talking to the tormentor, he is clear, decisive, instructive. Jesus does not negotiate with darkness, nor should we. He doesn't entertain it. He commands it. And the spirit convulses the boy, cries out, and comes out in verse 26. The boy looks so lifeless that they think he's dead. Maybe he was. If so, two miracles happened. Jesus takes him by the hand and lifts him up. And in verse 27, we're told that he is able to stand. That's what Jesus does. He is fierce against opposition, but he is gentle with the oppressed. He's tender toward the child, but he's authoritative toward the torment. He's compassionate toward the father, but he is confrontational with the demon. Whatever has tried to destroy you, Jesus is not passive. Whatever has tried to drown you, Jesus is not indifferent. Whatever tries to burn you, Jesus sees, and he is not far away. There is a kind of love in Jesus that does not merely sympathize, it intervenes. And he doesn't wait for the Father to tidy up his theology. He doesn't say, come back when your faith is flawless. He meets him in the middle. He meets him in the strange and in the sacred place where belief and unbelief collide. And the good news for London, because London has learned to be sophisticated about everything and certain about almost nothing, is that Jesus meets us. He doesn't require our sophistication. He requires our surrender. He will take a turned heart and a real cry over somebody's polished theology any day of the week. And the boy is set free. Afterward, Jesus and the disciples go into a house, and the disciples, still trying to work out why they failed, say, why could we not cast it out? In verse 28, I love that they ask. It means they're not pretending either. They're learning. Why didn't it work? What did we do wrong? And Jesus says, depending on the version of the story that you read, this kind can only come out through prayer, or in some versions, the versions I prefer, through prayer and fasting. He's not humiliating them. He's discipling them. He's teaching them that spiritual authority is not a technique that you master. It's a relationship that you live in. Prayer is not a ritual that you can perform. It is a dependence that you learn to practice. And there's a word here for us. Some battles do not move because we are busy. They move because we are near God, spending time with him, near in surrender, near in worship, not just singing, but yielding. You know that moment at the underground barrier when you tap it like you've done 1,000 times and the Jolly Oyster card doesn't work? Red light. So you walk into the barrier and then feel embarrassed. You try it again, and what does the little green digitized screen say? Seek assistance. And you stand there thinking, but I used this yesterday. I topped it up this morning. It always works, but won't work. Some of us feel that spiritually. The routines that used to carry us, our coping mechanisms, our momentum, even our religious familiarity aren't opening the gate anymore. And Jesus is saying, seek assistance. And we won't because we're afraid of looking silly. He's not asking us to seek assistance from a system. He's asking us to seek assistance from our Savior, Prayer is the moment when we stop forcing the barrier and we turn toward the one who can open what we cannot open. It isn't a last resort. It's a first response. It isn't the thing you do when everything else fails. It's the confession that Jesus is Lord and we are not. It's the acknowledgement that we don't have to understand God to trust him. This story holds up a mirror to us. I think we're living in a moment where many people are carrying hidden uncertainty and torment. Mental health pressures that can't neatly be resolved. Loneliness that doesn't disappear in a crowded city. Addictions that hide behind professional competencies. Financial worries that are straining us and we're afraid to tell anybody. Emotional exhaustion. People wrestling with identity, with anxiety, with meaning. We live in a city that is saturated with information but starving of wisdom. And in the middle of that, the Church of Jesus Christ can be tempted to become like the crowd, watching and reacting and arguing and analyzing and writing another strategy. But actually what we should do is bring people to Jesus. Mark 9 shows us that the kingdom pattern is this. Bring the need to Jesus. Jesus asks questions that dignify suffering. He receives honest prayer. He confronts evil. He raises what looks like death. And he teaches people to depend on God. So in the end, as you prepare to respond to what I'm saying, this isn't just a story. It's an invitation to you and to you online into a different way of life. But it's not an invitation to an idea or a belief system or a culture or a set of services. It's an invitation to a person, not me. It's an invitation to Jesus. Because Jesus is still alive and Jesus still acts and Jesus still saves. So let me, for a moment, online and here again, speak to those of you who may not yet be following Jesus or who have just begun doing so and you are unsure of where you stand with God. Mark chapter 9 is a picture of deliverance, freedom that is real. But the greatest deliverance that Jesus came to bring is deeper still. Because there's a bondage beneath our bondage. The Bible calls it sin. It's the brokenness in us and around us that we're unable to fix. We can't get rid of it by education or by politics or by technology or by achievement or by self-promotion. It's not just doing bad things, it's separation. It's a heart turned in upon itself. It's a person trying to live without God and wondering why life feels hollow. And here's the good news for all of us. Jesus didn't come just to improve your behavior. He didn't come to give you a personality makeover, no matter how much you or your friends think you need it. He came to rescue your whole life. He went to the cross, bearing sin, carrying shame, and taking judgment so that I and you could receive mercy and not have to pretend anymore. Forgiveness that we could never earn and grace that we could not perform for. He just came to give them to us. And he rose from the dead so that death doesn't get the final word. Your past doesn't get the final word. Your failure doesn't get the final word. Jesus gets the final word. So when the Father says, have pity on us, that's exactly what God offers in Jesus Christ. Pity, mercy, compassion, help. Not because we deserve it. but because Jesus is good. And here's what I love about this story. The father doesn't come with a CV. I know John's mother. I had lunch with Matthew's cousin. I know your stepfather, Joseph. I lived around the corner from you when you were growing up in Nazareth. No, he just comes with a cry. He comes with desperation because that's what salvation looks like. Be very careful that you don't assume that God anoints people who seem to have a very effective ministry and that it's them that is causing it. Jesus meets desperate people, and he'll even meet them through dodgy ministers because he's more interested in reaching the desperate person than keeping his reputation. He will use means that you would sniff your nose at. He will move in services that you would say, I would never go. That's all right. Jesus went. He reaches people where they are needed, where he is needed. That's not an endorsement of a ministry. That's an endorsement of the character of Jesus. That's a pointing to a God who is so compassionate and kind and gracious that he will put up with your theological exam in order to get to the people that need help from him. That's what salvation looks like. Not, Lord, look what I've done, but Lord, help me. Not, Lord, I'm impressive, but Lord, I'm in need. So as the musicians join me, I want to invite you to respond. But I don't want to rush past the moment. I don't want to manipulate it. I just want to be honest. Because I think there are probably three groups of people here, online and in the room. Those who are not yet following Jesus. You've been around faith. You've been curious about faith. You've been resistant to faith. You've been uncertain about faith. But tonight you know you need mercy. Tonight Jesus is calling you not to religion, but to himself. Come to Jesus. I'm going to give you a moment to do it in a few minutes. Because he's here. And he's ready to meet you, whoever you are. Secondly, there are those who believe, but they feel the fracture of their unbelief. I know there are people in this category here tonight. You have faith, but you're battling fatigue. You love Jesus, but you've been disappointed. You want to trust, but anxiety keeps talking in your ear. And tonight, the Father's prayer is your prayer. I believe. Help my unbelief. Then there's a third group of people. Those facing this kind of battle. This kind come not but by prayer and fasting, Jesus said. Something persistent, something deep, something that has resisted quick fixes, something where others condemn you and you condemn yourself, but you need to know tonight Jesus is not condemning you. He's inviting you into deeper dependence. This kind comes not only out only through prayer and fasting. He's drawing you closer. He's saying, come nearer. I can see the tears in your eyes. I can see the weariness in your face. Come closer, because I want to embrace it away. Some of us know what it is to sit in a waiting room watching the clock, clutching a number, grateful for help but tired of the process. Because if I'm really honest with you, waiting can wear our souls thin. And spiritually, some of you have been waiting for a very long time. waiting for change, waiting for healing, waiting for relief, waiting for God to move. What about this family in Mark 9? How long were they waiting? They've been waiting forever, waiting since childhood. And Jesus doesn't say, wait your turn. He just steps in. Sometimes the breakthrough begins not when everything is resolved, but when a weary person dares to pray again honestly, help me. So tonight I want to give you the language that heaven honors. It's in the story. If you can pray, Lord, I believe, then pray it. If all you can pray is, Lord, help, then pray that. And if your faith feels like a flicker, then bring the flicker. Jesus doesn't crush bruised reeds, and he doesn't snuff out smoldering wicks. If you want to give your life to Jesus tonight, whether for the first time or as an act of returned surrender, then quietly, silently in your heart, pray the prayer that I'm about to pray. Jesus Christ, I come to you. I don't come pretending. I come honest. I bring my faith and my doubts and my sin and my shame and my wounds and my weariness. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Have mercy on me, forgive my sin, wash me clean, break every chain over my life, fill me with your Spirit. Jesus, I turn to you and I trust you. I belong to you from this night on. I will follow you. The final word over this passage is not unbelief. The final word in this story is Jesus, not your certainty. Jesus. Not your perfection, not your strength, not your track record. The final word is Jesus. And the Jesus of Mark 9 is the Jesus of London tonight at 7:30 on the 3rd of May 2026. He is still near to the broken. He is still strong to save. He is still gentle with the honest and fierce against darkness. He is still rich in mercy. So bring him the real you. Bring him the messy prayer. Bring him the broken heart and the trembling faith. Because the prayer, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, is not just a confession of failure. It's a doorway into hope.